This episode of the Policy Viz podcast is brought to you by JUMP Statistical Discovery Software from SAS. JUMP, spelled J-M-P, is an easy-to-use tool that connects powerful analytics with interactive graphics. The drag-and-drop interface of JUMP enables quick exploration of data to identify patterns, interactions, and outliers. JUMP has a scripting language for reproducibility and interfacing with R. Click on this episode's sponsored link to receive a free info kit that includes an interview with DataViz experts Kaiser Fung and Alberto Cairo. In the interview, they discuss information gathering, analysis, and communicating results.
Welcome back to the Policy Viz podcast. I'm your host, John Schwabish. On this week's episode, I'm very excited to have with me as a guest, Zan Gregg, who is Research and Development Director at JUMP, which is a division of SAS. JUMP, as you may know, is a longtime supporter of the show, so I'm really glad to have Zan on, not only because of the support from JUMP, but also because he does a lot of very interesting work with lots of different things. And if you don't follow him on Twitter, you really should, because he's got a lot of great resources and insights on how to use JUMP and a variety of other tools. So Zan, thanks so much for coming on the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Glad to be here.
I'm really excited to talk to you, especially about some of the work you've done making over different visualizations. And I want to get your take on some of your, maybe you have some pet peeves in data visualization. Maybe you don't. We'll see. But before we dive into that, can you maybe introduce yourself for folks at home and maybe talk about JUMP a little bit and what it can do with respect to data visualization?
Okay, glad to. I'm a software developer by trade, and I sometimes say I'm an amateur data scientist. I've been focusing on more sort of data analysis and data visualization software for the past 15 years or so. And so part of that is actually not just writing the code, but exercising it and trying out things. JUMP is a division of SAS, which is a big stack company. But JUMP itself, it's spelled JMP, is a desktop product for Mac and Windows. And it does statistics with a focus on interactivity and visualization. One of the founding principles of JUMP is that every statistic has a graph. And so that makes it easier for people that aren't statisticians. Our main focus is more scientists and engineering. It makes it easier for them to understand what they're seeing. And everything is sort of personal and right in front of you, as opposed to being somewhere in the cloud and more enterprise kind of product. So that's what a little bit about what JUMP is. It's mostly UI driven. We have a scripting language for when you want to, make something reproducible so that you can run it again the next day. Basically, you can use the UI, discover something, save it to a script, and make it repeatable. So we like that combination. Some people never go into the scripting. Some people are just gung ho scripting all the time. But that's, a little bit of JUMP in a nutshell.
So you said that all statistics have a graph, and yet yesterday I watched a video of one of your talks where the title was All Graphs Are Wrong, But Some Are Useful, which I'll post on the show notes page. But can you talk a little bit about that talk and your perspective on that?
Sure. First of all, for people that aren't, don't follow statistics, the title is a reference to this famous statistician, George Box, had an aphorism, all models are wrong, but some are useful. And I sort of took a play off of that, the idea being, graphs, like models are just representations of the world. So they're wrong in that sense, that they aren't exactly the world, they're some approximation. But more to the point of what I spoke about was about how, there's a lot of error in graphs, not just the data. I mean, the data has error in it, variation, but also our perception. We don't see exactly what the data is behind the graph. You've probably seen the perceptual studies like the similar one by Cleveland and McGill, where they ranked visual attributes. But even then, the highest ranked attribute position was still had like a 3% error, and the lowest was not even that much worse. It was like 12 or 15% or something. So they all, all graphs, even the best ones, have some perceptual error, and it's just something it's good to keep in mind as we're making graphs. They all have some kind of message, and we have to realize that there's some loss of information just by the fact that our perception system is not perfect. It's not our eyes are not a camera, and our our brain is not a computer. Those are useful models, but they're not exactly right.
Yeah. And when you're working on developing a data visualization software, when you're thinking about permitting or letting the user choose a graph or guiding them through a graph, are you thinking about these sorts of perceptual issues? Are you trying to guide them into using a one particular graph type over another? For example, if I go into the Excel drop-down menu, I have 3D cones and I have all this sort of things that I would argue we shouldn't be using. But are you thinking about these perceptual issues as you're designing the software to guide the user to certain things and maybe away from other things?
Definitely, yeah. Probably William Cleveland's books on visualizing graphs, visualizing data, I guess was it called, was very important for me in recognizing the importance of defaulting to basically dot plots as the default view for almost any data set. One of the parts of Jump that I'm responsible for is called Graph Builder, which is a general purpose, make a graph from data, and it has to pick some default view, and it normally uses a dot plot unless you've got millions of points. In that case, it might summarize it with a box plot or something. So it definitely informs the defaults, and it also informs the priorities. We don't even have 3D cones. Maybe if we had as many developers as Microsoft does, we might add it to the bottom of the list. But
perfect.
Given that we have limited resources, we don't even get to the bottom of the list.
Yeah.
It definitely plays into defaults and priorities.
And how are you thinking about your user base as opposed to, say, Microsoft, right? So Microsoft's user base is basically everybody, whereas a user of Jump or user of SAS is a different type of user, is programming in a statistical language. How do you sort of segment the audience in that different way?
Well, they're not all programmers, for sure. A lot of our users are just using the menus and doing analyses or just creating graphs or usually both. But they're a little more technical, which is, in a way, it's a bit of a crutch for us because we don't have to make things as generic, the language and things like that. Sometimes we can use technical language, which we wouldn't be able to do if we were doing it for, everybody in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the main difference, is they're just a little more scientific. But as far as, there's plenty of things that are universal. We don't, just UI design, and basically trying to meet expectations is the important thing for us. Some things we do might be a little tricky, but we want them, once you learn the Jump way, we want them to always live up to that way.
Right. And do you find that there are certain things that your users prioritize over other things? I mean, they're prioritizing speed versus elegance of the final product, or there are things that you find that they really prioritize?
It's pretty broad. Different users have different priorities. Speed is definitely a priority for us, and being able to handle unlimited amount of data. Well, we're limited by the amount of memory in a machine. Not much of a limit these days. Some users are wanting to have the most advanced, stat techniques, the gradient boosting and things like that, which we have. Some of them want a very specialty just part of the application. Like they want control charts or survival analysis or things like that. They're a little more specialized.
Right. All right.
But it's generally, because of that diversity, a lot of companies just like the fact that Jump, has a breadth of all those things, but still with one sort of core focus.
Sure. One of the other things that you do, or at least that I see publicly, aside from work on Jump, are the makeovers you do. And I'll post a number of different ones that we've been sort of talking about offline onto the show notes page. So I think the one that I found interesting for a couple of different reasons is the Wall Street Journal measles heat map that you remade in Jump. Just because I think that's a really interesting example of an alternative way to show a fairly standard time series graph. Can you sort of walk through for us what your thinking is when you are remaking a graph? What are your goals? What are you looking for when you are going to remake something? What goes through your mind as you say, this is a graph I want to remake and write a blog post about it and share with, share the world with the world. I want to share them this thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, that was that was a lot of fun. And that was one that a lot of people, actually several folks wrote about, did some, a little bit of criticism and commentary. So that one should be widely known. But it was, it's a heat map of measles rates in the U.S. over time, with every state and every year getting a colored cell. Well, just to step back a little bit on the general question of why, several reasons. One is just, to educate myself, practice the craft, basically, trying to see if I can create what they created, or I can do something a little different, or a little better, explore and share that with other people if it does end up being something that might be better or might be more suitable in a, if you had a different message with the same data, for instance. And I also want to basically sort of QA the graphic, make sure it came out right, which sometimes I've done. Tried to redo things, and it turned out to find an error in the original. So that's gratifying. But the Wall Street Journal heat map was interesting because the data was different than I thought it would be when I got the data from their source, because it had a lot of missing values in it, which they didn't focus too much on in the original. I mean, they indicated when the whole year was missing, but not when half the year was missing. And that sort of, brought up an interesting question of what do you do when half the year is missing? Do you assume it was zero for that half of the year, or assume it was, the same as the half year you have? So there's all different ways you might want to show that or indicate it, or throughout the whole year or whatever. I think that's, one of the valuable things about trying to do the makeovers is you realize it's a little more complicated than it looks. I mean, the data is a little more complicated. It's not as clean as it looks or as you would expect. And you might discover why they did certain things. When I first saw that heat map, actually, when I first saw it, it looked, I thought, wow, this is great. The country had measles and then it didn't have measles. So it works in that sense. But then I sort of didn't like the color scheme a little bit, because it goes from blue to green to red, or maybe yellow to red. And it wasn't quite perceptually aligned. And I thought, I'll try something that's a little more sequential color scheme. And then you realize, well, they did it that way because of it's for skewed data. There's very high rates at the beginning of the century and then low rates after that. And if you just did a plain sequential scheme, you wouldn't be able to see both of the, amount of variation. So I can understand a little bit why they did the multiple colors. Maybe not. I never understood why they mixed in green in there. I can imagine just going, light blue to dark blue and light red to dark red or something.
Yeah.
But those are the kind of things that come up as you try these makeovers.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of these, well, not a lot, but there's a few of these projects out there with makeovers. I think right now the most popular one is probably the Monday Makeover project from a couple folks at Tableau. There's also my HelpMeViz project. Mm-hmm. There's Cross-Validated. And there's other sorts of things out there, people doing makeovers. And a couple of years ago, Fernando Villegas and Martin Wattenberg wrote a post about the responsibility of the person doing the makeover. So when you are doing a makeover, or you're seeing other people do makeovers, how do you feel the person doing the makeover, what are the responsibilities or even the ethics of the person doing the makeover with respect to the, the person who created the original? I mean, a lot of the things that we are making over we're not exactly asking the original creator, hey, do you mind if I take a look at this? Do you mind if I edit it or do a makeover? We're just sort of taking and say, I think this could be improved. So do you think there are challenges there? Do you think there are ethical issues there? I mean, where do you sort of see this thing about making graphs over without sort of having a communication with the original creator?
Yeah, I haven't thought about it from that angle. When I do a makeover, I make sure to add attribution of the original. And usually when I show a picture of what I'm making over, I try to make it a sort of a thumbnail picture, just so I don't want to make it look like I'm trying to get attention by posting their graph, essentially.
Right.
So that's, that's about as far as I go in that angle. I have contacted a few folks when I was doing makeovers, but it wasn't for that reason. It was usually because I wanted to figure out why they did things a certain way or get their original data. But that I haven't actually got much success with that, so I haven't been doing it lately.
I mean, it's an interesting field. It's an interesting field because if we write a critical review of a book, let's just say, you don't see a lot of critics, I don't think, sort of taking a passage out of a book and saying, I didn't like this passage this way, and so I would rewrite it this way. But in the field of data viz, we tend to do that. We say, I don't like it this way. I'm going to try to remake it this other way. And in some senses, that I don't know if it's good or better or worse. In some ways, we're trying to put our own spin on it or take a different view, or at least, I guess, put ourselves on the line a little bit, right? Because we're saying, this is what I would have tried to, this is what I would try to do, and I think it's better, but also maybe not.
Yeah, that's right. It's not necessarily better, but you're just partly just showing some other ideas or other angles. But I think I feel like you're, sort of like a level above normal criticism, because you're actually not just saying, these colors are bad, these labels are bad, or whatever. You're actually trying to redo it. So I think, in a way, that's a bit higher than, mm-hmm. Sort of more ethical than a regular criticism. But I can see your point about the, how it doesn't quite map well to, to prose or something like that.
Right. I mean, I think you have this thing where, you remake a visualization, and maybe the goal of the original author was to communicate to some particular audience, and I, as the person doing the makeover, say, oh, well, I would have done it this way, but the audience that I have in mind is slightly is a different audience, and therefore my makeover maybe in some cases doesn't make sense to do it my way because I'm thinking about a different audience. So it's just, I think, an interesting responsibility that for those of us who are making things over to think about who the creator is. And what constraints or goals they have that we may not be aware of, or that we may not share, either obviously or sort of implicitly.
Yeah, I think the audience is a big factor, and that's, the Wall Street Journal heat map is a good example, because that one, the original viz is probably great for its audience, but if you're trying to do something more analytical, then you might want to either, both have your colors align more perceptually, or maybe even use a normal time series line graph or something like that.
Right. I mean, you also make the good point that you can sometimes discover issues or even mistakes. So you mentioned that sort of how do you deal with the missing data issue in the heat map one. You also did sort of a tile grid map thing in, I think it was the summertime, that Chris Ingram had done from the Post on mosquitoes. And if I recall correctly, you had found an error in for the Washington, D.C. data. Is that right?
Yeah, everything after Washington, D.C. was off by one, all the states mislabeled. Mm. I think he had two data sets he was merging, and one had D.C. and the other didn't, and ended up getting messed up.
Right.
And that one, when I first looked at it, it was actually because this doesn't look right. Why is, Tennessee so much different from Arkansas, or why is Alabama so much different from Georgia? And it turns out it's because, Alabama was right, but Georgia was shifted, was another state.
Right.
Well, yeah, I've mentioned that to him, and he corrected it right away. This is on his Washington Post wonk blog.
Right. And I think part of that has to do with how you, as the person doing the makeover, approaches it, right? If you approach it as, pointing fingers and, with that sort of frowny face, critical eye, as opposed to I'm coming into it with this perspective of I'm just want to try it in this tool and I want to explore these data, I think, that's where you get sort of a positive response from the original creator versus maybe a negative response you would from someone else. So I want to talk about or ask you about whether you have any, are there any data viz practices or chart types that you're sort of a real absolutist about? So we've got sort of like the pie chart debate, obviously. We have Stephen Few on one side saying no round things ever. And then we've got, maybe like David McCandless on the other side using sort of all different shapes and whatever. So are there things that sort of drive you up the wall where you're like, no, you should never, ever do X?
I wouldn't say on an absolute level, but there's definitely a lot of things like that that'll make me cringe and I'll avoid, doing them personally. But
right.
I used to be a little more absolute about things, but I've come to realize, sometimes the low precision graph is not that bad because your data is low precision or the message is not that critical. It's just a, vaguely informative graph anyway, or the data is, mm-hmm. And like I've mentioned in that, Bill Cleveland research about the ranking of the attributes. I mean, the best, even though position was best at 3% error, the whatever color intensity or the last one was only like 15% error. So there's, I mean, it's not like it's, you know, they're that much different. Right. Not like one is 50% error or something. For instance, I used to really cringe when I would see pie charts in a financial report or something like that. You know, money's important. I would think they should be using something more accurate. But then I realized, you know, people aren't making decisions based on that pie chart. That's just sort of a little, you know, by the way, here's the vague idea of what, you know, how our assets are divided or something like that. But if you really care, you're going to, you know, need to dive in more than that anyway. Mm-hmm. And the same is for likes of rainbow color scale or just round things in general. dual y-axis or things like that.
Right. Do you have any love or hate feelings or sentiments about interactivity or animation? I mean, that's a big thing. Now everybody wants to be able to make, you know, the big interactive thing that they see on the New York Times or the Washington Post website. Do you have folks that you try to, like, talk back from the edge that they want to make big interactives or big animated things? Say, well, really, you just need a bar chart. You know, let's make the bar chart.
Yeah, I usually will prefer like a panels of bar charts or, you know, small multiples kind of thing. The animation is, I mean, I'm always seeing these, you know, animations recently. You've seen some about the global temperature over time. They'll, you know, have it each year sort of overlaid on top of the previous one in an animation. And I always want to like stop it at the last frame so I can see all of them, but they don't really support that, at least in an animated GIF.
Right.
I think the animation, you know, everyone, you know, we have, you know, animated plots, and we sort of, you know, got that when a lot of people did, when after seeing Hans Rosling do it. And I think, and that's actually where I think it works best is when it's narrated. You know, when you've got someone sort of guiding you along like he did, saying, here's the beginning here. We've got these countries, you know, here and these other countries over there, and now watch them merge together as I go forward kind of thing. But, you know, so when you got that, the animation really, you know, supports the message very well.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just not, I'd usually just, you know, just show me the whole thing.
Yeah. I mean, I think you hit on something there, because the thing about the Rosling piece is what is so important about it is his narration of the graphs. But I think for most people, mm-hmm. we're creating graphs that are sort of like the one chart. Like, here's the chart that go, here's figure one. And so we don't have sort of that ability to do that narration without maybe having the small multiples or having the panels. So I think it's a little tricky, as it were, to sort of do the narration when you're in a static world where you don't have someone who's sort of leading you. You don't see what the endpoint is because they're going to walk you through it to that endpoint, as opposed to here's a page of the graphs and you can sort of see them all at one shot.
Right. Yeah. I mean, he's got the excitement in his voice and all that drama. And if you take that away and just look at the bubbles moving, you're not going to get his message.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's right. Which I think leads into a whole other discussion about stories and data and narration that is a topic close to my heart these days. But we'll pause on that and pick that up at another time. Zan, I want to thank you for coming on the show. Also, because now at least I know how to pronounce your first name. So hopefully others are, you know, now have that.
That's too. One of the great things about your podcast is I get to find out how to pronounce everyone's name. I never would have guessed Lean Harrison, for instance.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to do. Just bring people together so they understand how to pronounce each other's names. So that's great. Zan, thanks so much for coming on the show. I appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks for having me. Pleasure.
And thanks to everyone for tuning in to this week's episodes. I will, of course, post all of Zan's stuff, his makeovers and his videos, to the show notes. And so if you have questions or comments or suggestions about this episode or any other episode for the show, please do get in touch on the website or on Twitter. So until next time, this has been the Policy Viz Podcast. Thanks so much for listening.
This episode of the Policy Viz Podcast is brought to you by Jump Statistical Discovery Software from SAS. Jump, spelled JMP, is an easy-to-use tool that connects powerful analytics with interactive graphics. The drag-and-drop interface of Jump enables quick exploration of data to identify patterns, interactions, and outliers. Jump has a scripting language for reproducibility and interfacing with R. Click on this episode's sponsored link to receive a free info kit that includes an interview with DataViz experts Kaiser Fung and Alberto Cairo. In the interview, they discuss information gathering, analysis, and communicating results.